Welcome to Side B. 欢迎你来到 B 面。
Lesson 37. It was an early morning in summer. In the streets, sleepy-eyed people were moving quickly, heading towards their jobs. This was the beginning of another ordinary day in New York City. But this day was to be different. Waiting above the crowded streets, on top of a building, 110 stories high, was Philippe Petit. This daring Frenchman was about to walk a tightrope between the two towers of the World Trade Center. Philippe took his first step with great care. The wire held. Now he was sure he could do it. With only a balancing pole, Philippe walked his way across, a distance of 131 feet. Soon, the rush hour crowds began to notice. What a wonder! There, 1,350 feet above the street, a tiny figure was walking on air. Philippe made 7 trips back and forth. He wasn't satisfied with just walking. At times he would turn, sit down, and even go on his knees. Once, he had the astonishing courage to lie down on the thin thread, and thousands of terrified watchers stared with their hearts beating fast. After the 45-minute show, Philippe was taken to the police station. He was asked why he did it. Philippe shrugged and said, "When I see two tall buildings, I walk." Lesson 38. A strange thing happened to me last Sunday. It was such a beautiful day that I went for a drive in the country. On the way back home, my car stopped. It was out of gas on a lonely road far from town. I decided to walk until I found someone who could sell some gas. I'd walked almost a mile before I finally found a house near the road. I was glad to see it because it was getting dark. I knocked at the door and a little old lady with long white hair answered. She said, "I've been waiting for you for a long time. Come in. Tea is almost ready." "But I only came for some gas," I answered. I couldn't imagine what she was talking about. "Oh, Alfred, gas? You used to like tea." I quickly explained that my car was out of gas, but she didn't seem to hear me. She just kept calling me Alfred and talking about how long it had been since she had seen me. She was acting very strangely, and I was anxious to leave. As soon as she went to get the tea, I went out of the house as fast as I could. Fortunately, there was another house down the road, and I was able to buy the gas I needed. When I told the man about my experience, he said, "Oh, that's Miss Emily. She lives by herself in that big house. She's out of her mind, but she wouldn't hurt anyone. She is still waiting for the man she was supposed to marry 30 years ago. The day before their wedding, he left home and never came back because of the war." Lesson 39. The customs in different countries, as well as in different times, are rather different. Things considered impolite many years ago are now acceptable. Just a few years ago, it was considered impolite for a man to smoke in the street. No man who thought of himself as a gentleman made a fool of himself by smoking when a lady was in the room. What about the customs of eating and drinking in different countries? If we have dinner with a Chinese host, he always puts more food onto our plates as soon as we have emptied them. That often discomforts us greatly. We have to eat the food, even if we don't want to, because it is considered bad manners in the West to leave one's food on the plate. We have also noticed that when a Chinese sits at an American's party, he very often refuses the offer of food or drink, though he is in fact still hungry or thirsty. This might be good manners in China, but it is not in the West at all. In the United States, it is impolite to keep asking someone again and again or insist on his accepting something. Americans have a direct way of speaking. If they want something, they will ask for it. If not, they will say, "No thanks." When an American is served with beer by the host, for example, he might say, "No thanks, I'll take some coffee if you have it." This is what an American will do. So when you go to the United States, you'd better remember the famous saying, "When in Rome, do as the Romans do." Lesson 40. I was a reporter for an evening paper in London. One day I was asked to write a few articles on begging in London. It was then that all my adventures started. I decided that the best way of collecting facts for my articles would be to become a beggar myself for just one day. When I was an actor, of course, I had learned all the skills of makeup, and I now made good use of them. I painted my face and fixed my upper lip in an ugly twist. Red hair and old clothes were the only other things necessary. I then placed myself in one of the busiest streets. I pretended to be a beggar. At home that night, I was surprised to find that I'd received more than a pound. Well, you can imagine how hard it was to settle down to work hard on the articles at 2 pounds a week. When I knew that I could make as much as that in a single day, I gave up my post, though my pride was hurt. I had unusual advantages. My knowledge of makeup helped me a great deal, and my clever answers quickly made me almost a public character. All day and every day, the money poured into my cap. I usually received at least 2 pounds in a day. In the end, I could take a large house in the country. Nobody had any idea where my money really came from. My dear wife knew that I had business in London. That was all.
Hey, man, you're making great progress. You just let you know, she's not going to achieve it.
Dong Diva, you're the function.
Go on to the next.
Lesson 41. James sat outside the office waiting for the interview. He felt so nervous that he didn't know what to do with himself. The person who had gone in before him had been in there for nearly an hour, and she looked so confident when she went in. Not like James. He felt sure that she had already got the job. The problem was that he wanted this job so much. It meant everything to him. He had thought about it so much before the day of the interview. He had imagined himself performing brilliantly at the interview and being offered the job immediately. But now, here he was feeling terrible. He couldn't remember all those things he had planned to say. At that moment, he almost decided to get up and leave. But no, he had to do this. He had spent so much time considering it that he couldn't give up like that. His hands were hot and sticky, and his mouth felt dry. At last, the door of the office opened. The woman who had gone in an hour earlier came out looking very pleased with herself. She smiled sympathetically at James. At that moment, James hated her. The managing director then appeared at the office door. "Would you like to come in now, Mr. Davis? I'm sorry to have kept you waiting." James suddenly wished that he had gone home after all. He got up, legs shaking and forehead sweating, and wondered whether he looked as terrified as he felt. Lesson 42. Everybody knows Charlie Chaplin, a world-famous comic actor. People everywhere have laughed at Charlie Chaplin's films until tears ran down their faces. From his first appearance, they know what will happen. The little man always has a black mustache, wide-open eyes, a round black hat, and shoes too large for his feet. He'll struggle through snow and fall from windows. He'll fight men who are twice his size, fall in love with women who hardly notice him, and try to hug them. The little tramp that Charlie Chaplin played in dozens of films makes all kinds of stupid mistakes. He is always in trouble, but he never gives up. He dreams of becoming a great man. Even people who don't understand English can enjoy Chaplin's films because they are mostly silent. It isn't what he says that makes people laugh. His comedy doesn't depend on words. It depends on little actions which mean the same thing to people all over the world. Chaplin raises his thick eyebrows or rolls his eyes. He hides behind a fat lady or under a table to escape from his enemies. He dresses well and pretends to be a rich and important man. It is all so hopeless and impossible that he makes us laugh. This is the secret of Chaplin's huge success. Lesson 43. When sailors are allowed ashore after a long time at sea, they sometimes get drunk and cause trouble. For this reason, the Navy always has its police in big ports. Whenever sailors cause trouble, the police come and deal with it. One day, the police in a big seaport received a telephone call from a bar in the town. The barman said that a big sailor had got drunk and was breaking the furniture in the bar. The officer in charge of the police guard that evening said that he would come immediately. Now, officers who had to go and punish heavily drunk sailors usually chose the biggest policeman they could find to go with them. But this particular officer did not do this. Instead, he chose the smallest and weakest-looking man he could find to go to the bar with him and seize the sailor. Another officer, who happened to be there, was surprised when he saw the officer of the guard choose such a small man. So he said to him, "Why don't you take a big man with you? You have to fight a sailor who is drunk." "Yes, you are quite right," answered the officer of the guard. "That is exactly why I am taking this small man. If you see two policemen coming at you, and one is much smaller than the other, which one will you attack? Lesson 44. Every summer, a great many students travel to other countries, looking for work and adventure. Most of the chances are in seasonal work, mainly connected with tourism and agriculture. The pay is usually poor, but most people work abroad for the excitement of travel. You can pick grapes in France, entertain kids at American summer camps, and of course, there are always jobs in hotels and restaurants. But it is not easy to find work. Unless you speak the language of the country well, there will be very few openings, says Anthea Ellis, an advisor on vacation work for students. If you work with a family in Italy, you'll have to speak Italian. When you wash dishes in a restaurant in Paris, the owner will expect you to speak French. British students only have a language advantage for jobs in the USA and Australia. Not everybody enjoys the experience. Sarah James was employed to help 40 American children in Europe. The two teachers with the children had never been abroad. One child lost his passport. Another became seriously ill and was flown home. The whole group was thrown out of one hotel because of the noise they made, and Sarah herself was robbed on her only free evening of the entire trip. I did visit a lot of new places, she said, but it wasn't worth it. The pay was poor, and it really was a 24-hour-a-day job. The kids never slept. The trouble is, students expect to have an easy time of it, Anthea Ellis points out. After all, they see it as a holiday. In practice, though, you have to work hard. At the same time, all vacation work is casual work. You'll have a job when the hotel, the restaurant, or the campsite is busy. In other words, you'll work if it's convenient for the company that employs you. But you have few employee rights. As soon as the holiday season finishes, they'll get rid of you. Lesson 45. To be a good teacher, you need some of the gifts of good actors. You must be able to hold the attention and interest of your students. You must be a clear speaker with a good, strong, pleasing voice which is fully under your control. And you must be able to act what you are teaching in order to make its meaning clear. Watch a good teacher and you will see that he does not sit motionless before his class. He stands the whole time he is teaching. He walks about, using his arms, hands, and fingers to help him in his explanations and his face to express feelings. Listen to him. And you will hear the loudness, the quality, and the musical tone of his voice always changing according to what he is talking about. The fact a good teacher has some of the gifts of a good actor does not mean that he will indeed be able to act well on the stage, for there are very important differences between the teacher's work and the actor's. The actor has to speak words which he has learnt by heart. He has to repeat exactly the same words each time he plays a certain part. Even his movements and the ways in which he uses his voice are usually fixed before. What he has to do is make all these carefully learnt words and actions seem natural on the stage. The good teacher works in quite a different way. His students take an active part in his play. They ask and answer questions. They obey orders. And if they do not understand something, they say so. The teacher, therefore, has to suit his act to the needs of his students, which is his class.
Don't give up, 永不放弃。
我会一直坚持到底，直到我成功。
I will persevere till I succeed.
Lesson 46. I remember vividly that first English class in the last term of high school. We boys, there were no girls in the school, were waiting expectantly for the new teacher to appear. Before long, through the door came a tall, ordinary-looking man of about 40. He said shyly, "Good afternoon, gentlemen." His voice had a surprising tone of respect, almost as if he were addressing the Supreme Court instead of a group of youngsters. He wrote his name on the blackboard, Wilmer T. Stone, then sat on the front of his desk. "Gentlemen," he began, "we are now this term, our last, to continue your study of English. I know we shall enjoy learning with and from one another. We are going to learn something about journalism and how to get out your weekly school paper. Especially, we are going to try to feel the joy of good literature, and maybe some of us will really get interested in reading and writing. A man who reads lives many lives. A man who doesn't walks the earth with a blindfold. If I had to put all my advice into a single word, it would be browse." Mr. Stone went on like that, speaking in a friendly and understanding tone. The end of the class came much too soon, and we boys had to leave the classroom with an unexpected feeling of excitement. Lesson 47. It must have been after 2 o'clock in the morning when the last guests took their leave, and though we had enjoyed their stay, my wife and I were quite thankful to shut the door on them. We left all the dirty dishes and glasses as they were, and after opening a few windows to let some fresh air in and the smell of food out, we climbed into bed and fell asleep. I couldn't have been asleep for more than half an hour when I awoke to a strong smell of smoke. Still half asleep, I stepped into the living room, and there, through heavy clouds of smoke, I saw that one of the curtains was on fire. I should have closed the windows then without delay, but instead I tried to beat out the fire with a folded newspaper. When this failed, I hurried into the kitchen to bring a bucket and filled it with water. At the same time, I shouted to Barbara, who hurriedly phoned to summon the fire brigade before coming to help me. We had to work at top speed, carrying buckets of water to prevent the fire from spreading. We had kept it under control until the firemen arrived. Fortunately, they arrived in no time, and they had little difficulty in putting out the fire.
Goodness gracious, great balls of fire!
Lesson 48. Though different educational systems have different purposes, one thing is certain. All students should take part in examinations. In the English educational system, students take three very important examinations. The first is the 11+, which is taken at or somewhat past the age of 11. At one time, the ability shown on the 11+ would have determined if a child stayed in school. Now, however, all children continue in comprehensive schools, and the 11+ determines which courses of study the child will follow. At the age of 15 or 16, the students are tested for the ordinary level of the General Certificate of Education. This examination covers a wide range of subjects. Once students have passed this exam, they are allowed to specialize, so that two-thirds or more of their courses will be in physics, chemistry, classical languages, or whatever they wish to study at great length. The final examination, at 18, covers only the content of the special subjects. Even at the universities, students study only in their concentrated area, and few students ever venture outside that subject again. In a sense, the English boy or girl is a specialist from the age of 15. Lesson 49. Although Nasruddin was a poor man, he decided one day to take King Tamerlane a roast goose as a present. Now Nasruddin had not had much to eat that day, and soon the smell of the roast goose as he carried it to the king became too much for him, so he tore off one of its legs and ate it. When he came before the king and offered him the goose, Tamerlane at once noticed that one of the legs was missing. Now, he had himself been born with one bad leg, so that he had never been able to walk properly. When he saw that the goose that Nasruddin was offering him had only one leg, he therefore thought that Nasruddin had done this on purpose to remind him of his own leg. Of course, he was very angry, and as he was a man who was not slow to punish those who angered him, Nasruddin was very frightened. "Where is the goose's other leg?" the king shouted. "Your Majesty," answered Nasruddin, trembling, "all the geese in this part of the country have one leg only." "So you think I'm a fool, do you?" Tamerlane shouted again. "Certainly not, Your Majesty," said Nasruddin. "If Your Majesty will look out of the window, you will see geese with one leg by the side of your pond." Tamerlane looked out of the window, and there the geese were resting on one leg beside the water. The king at once ordered one of his servants to chase the birds away. The servant took a big stick and threw it at them, and of course they put down their other legs and ran away. "There," said Tamerlane, "you are lying, Nasruddin. That shows the geese in this part of the country have two legs, like all other geese." "I beg your pardon, Your Majesty," answered Nasruddin, "but it doesn't show anything of the kind. If your servant threw a stick like that at me, I might grow two more legs myself to help me to run away faster." Lesson 50. Norman Cousins was a businessman from the United States who often traveled around the world on business. He enjoyed his work and traveling. Then, after returning to the United States from a tiring trip to the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, USSR, Mr. Cousins got sick. Because he had pushed his body to the limit of its strength on the trip, a change began to take place inside him. The material between his bones became weak. In less than 1 week after his return, he could not stand. Every move that he made was painful. He was not able to sleep at night. The doctors told him that they did not know how to cure Mr. Cousins' problem, and he might never get over the illness. Mr. Cousins, however, refused to give up hope. Mr. Cousins thought that unhappy thoughts were causing bad chemical changes in his body. He did not want to take medicine to cure himself. Instead, he felt that happy thoughts or laughter might cure his illness. He began to experiment on himself while still in the hospital by watching funny shows on television. Mr. Cousins quickly found that 10 minutes of real laughter during the day gave him 2 hours of pain-free sleep at night. Deciding the doctors could not help him, Mr. Cousins left the hospital and checked into a hotel room where he could continue his experiments with laughter. For 8 days, Mr. Cousins rested in the hotel room watching funny shows on television, reading funny books, and sleeping whenever he felt tired. Within 3 weeks, he felt well enough to take a vacation to Puerto Rico, where he began running on the beach for exercise. After a few months, Mr. Cousins returned to work. He laughed himself back to health. This is Jim again, wishing you the very best of luck.